The Tom Woods Show, episode 1148.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you enjoy this podcast and my sister show, Contra Krugman, you will love the Contra Cruise, which we are sailing on for the third year in a row. This year, we'll be joined by the Mises Institute's Jeff Deist, Brett Vanat of the School Sucks podcast, and television producer, actress, and cryptocurrency authority, Naomi Brockwell. It's an amazing time. Get the details quickly at ContraCruise.com.
Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I am joined today by Professor Gerard Casey, who is Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at University College Dublin. He's the author of numerous books, including his magnum opus, Freedom's Progress? A History of Political Thought. It's a book we've covered in numerous episodes of this show because it's just huge. It's an astonishing book. And today I thought we'd talk about Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who's been very influential. He lived from 1712 to 1778. He's exerted influence on the world in ways that you can decide for yourself whether they've been positive or negative, but he's a very, very important figure. And I thought that'd be an interesting part of the Casey book to talk about. So I'm very glad to welcome Professor Casey back. Gerard Casey, thanks for being here once again.
Thank you very much, Tom. Good to be back.
It's fun to talk about somebody as evil as Rousseau, especially because he's not always portrayed that way. You know, he was an idealist. He was this or that. Whatever he is, he's never presented quite the right way. And there are so many works we can talk about. And I don't mean like 807, but I mean he has works, each of which are significant. I mean, at least five major works that we could discuss that have been influential, people have commented on for a long time. What about the personal life of Rousseau? There's a book by Paul Johnson called Intellectuals, where he goes through, I don't remember if Rousseau's in that book, but he's primarily 20th century intellectuals, and he goes through the personal biographies of each of these people and suggests that just maybe aspects of their personal lives and their personal failings just so happen to appear to seep into their political thought and their published work. And I wonder if that may be true. I mean, look, I wouldn't want to be judged in this way by future generations. But look, if I did as much damage as Rousseau has done, I think I would say, hey, it's only fair to do what you have to do in analyzing me. So maybe even looking at the confessions might be an interesting place to start.
Yeah, he's an extraordinary character. I mean, I think I make the point that there are some thinkers for whose personal lives, if you like, don't impact on their thoughts at all. I mean, you know nothing about them, and really, you don't need to know anything about them. And then there are other thinkers like St. Augustine, for example, who, you know, if he's writing, you know what he had for breakfast. He's that kind of character. And Rousseau is one of these people whose personal life, whose writings, if you like, are to some extent an exteriorization of what he's feeling, what he's thinking, and especially why he's not getting the appreciation he thinks he deserves. He has to be, I would suspect, if you were to make a list of the least likable people in the world, in the world of authorship and political philosophy and so on, Rousseau is either at or very close to the top. He had this unerring capacity, if you like, for alienating almost everybody, including including David Hume, who among the philosophers was a really remarkably charitable character and tried to befriend Rousseau, but pay the penalty for it because Rousseau just stabbed him in the back, as it were. So he is immensely a dislikable character. Now, you might say, well, that doesn't really matter. Who cares? I mean, you know, likable, dislikable, you know, what we need to look at are his writings. But unfortunately, in Rousseau's case, as I just said, his what he's writing about really is coming out from his inside. So his character, if you like, affects what he does.
You mentioned something about Rousseau that we might apply to a great many other thinkers, that he is very profoundly interested in and affected by the affairs of and ups and downs of mankind in general, but not so much by the individual. You know, he's not so concerned about the particular individuals for whom he may have some special connection.
Yes, he has. Again, it's one of these things. So I'm sure many people among your listeners will be aware of this. There are people in the world of politics and political affairs who seem to have this incredible love of humanity that never manages to manifest itself in the love of any particular human being. And in fact, seems to be very often to be consistent with, and at least in their eyes, with a sort of radical dislike. So Rousseau is one of these people who seem to have this incredible capacity to love human beings in the round, but never any particular human being. And in fact, in his personal relations, managed, as I said already, to alienate almost everybody who had any dealings with him. Was profoundly ungrateful and self-centered, narcissistic and self-pitying, and had a whole host of personal unpleasant characteristics. An unfortunate character, as I say in my book, not the kind of guy you would want to take out for a drink.
Yeah, no kidding. Now, what kind of things do we learn in his confessions, and how would you compare them to the confessions of St. Augustine?
Well, I suppose the only thing they have in common is that they did actually both write confessions.
Yeah.
But apart from that, Rousseau is a large scale exercise in exculpation. Why, in other words, he's telling us why he's so wonderful, why he's appreciated, and why everybody else is not as wonderful as he is. I know that sounds really sort of sweeping, but that's essentially it. I mean, somebody once remarked that, confessions and autobiographies are generally unreliable, and that may well be true. But I suspect that Rousseau's one is spectacularly unreliable. But even at that, it does reveal something of his character. And he was immensely self-centered. We all are, I suppose, to some extent, but massively is so in the case of Rousseau.
So what is the value, if we want to understand Rousseau, what's the value to reading this work?
Well, I would say let's take a specific example. Rousseau was, as quite a few people were at the particular time, interested in education and the upbringing of children, which is perfectly respectable enterprise, and there's nothing wrong in writing about that, except that in his own personal life, he managed to have 5 children for whom he provided no support whatsoever and nothing by way of education. I think, again, most of your listeners will really appreciate that if you want to know what somebody is like, don't ask them to tell you what they think and what their principles are, but actually observe what they do. And so Rousseau was a spectacular failure as a father, except in actually producing his progeny. He effectively abandoned them to an orphanage, which had a 66% sort of death rate in the first or second year. And then had the cheek back to suggest that he did this for their welfare and not simply because he was too mean to provide for their welfare, as he should have done.
All right, let's go on. Of course, everybody wants to talk, or at least by everybody, I mean me. I want to talk about the social contract eventually. But let's talk about the first and second discourses, because here we can easily overlook these in our race to get to the social contract. And there's a lot to talk about here. The first discourse, I'm trying to think back to my graduate school or even actually undergrad days. This was an entry into some kind of contest about the way that the sciences and whatever else have advanced civilization, and he suggested that it was actually quite the opposite.
Yeah, it was an entry in a competition, and clearly the organizers of the competition were expecting people to say, this is how we've, how we've progressed, or in this particular way, or in that particular way. And Rousseau, and to give him credit, took the contrarian view and said, no, in fact, it's actually gone the other way around. The sciences and philosophy and all of these things are actually an indication of the extent to which human beings have, as it were, deteriorated from some kind of original sort of innocent condition. And I think it was the sheer shock of having somebody take this contrarian view that got him the prize. Others have remarked, including Paul Johnson, whom you mentioned earlier, that the first discourse, when you read it now, seems, in Johnson's words, to be feeble and paltry. And another writer called Robert Whelan has remarked that, in fact, it's largely plagiarized from Montaigne's essay on the cannibals, published about 150 or 170 years before Rousseau wrote his piece. I actually haven't verified this myself, so I have to go on what Whelan said here. But yeah, it's a very strange sort of discourse. It's primarily the first discourse which gives us the idea, the very common idea I have, that Rousseau had this idea that of the noble savage, the idea of, like, that original man was a sort of incredibly noble beast, to be contrasted with the degraded and depraved condition of mankind in later ages. That's not quite accurate.
I hadn't heard that accusation of plagiarism. Now I'm interested. I want to go take a look, although it's kind of an odd use of my time, but for some reason I feel compelled to take a look at it. Well, the second discourse, I think, is the one that's generated more discussion, because there are not that many people, I think, who would really follow his argument. I don't mean would understand it, but who really would follow along with him and come out on the other side agreeing with him. But with the second discourse, when he's talking about inequality and property, well, here he does have, for good or for ill, but obviously entirely for ill, people who agree with him on where the roots of human inequality come from. So let's turn our attention to that. What is his conclusion in looking at this question?
Well, his conclusion is that, if you like, man in a state of nature, and of course the idea of the state of nature is a common trope among philosophers of this period, is really an innocent being. Now, it's hard to describe what he would be. If you contrast him with Hobbes, okay, for Hobbes, human beings in a state of nature were in a sort of Darwinian condition, sort of nature red in tooth and claw, fighting one another and struggling and so on. Rousseau's idea is that they were in some kind of pre-Edenic condition. They sort of, I don't know, sort of ambled around like some kind of gentle ape, okay, sort of picking fruit off the tree and so on. It's hard even to recognize It's hard even to recognize Rousseau's idea of a human being as indeed human beings. In my book, I comment that they were rather like chimpanzees that had been strategically shaved and dressed in a suit. And it's not even so much that they were sort of initially good. It's that they were sort of pre-moral. You know, just as, for example, we don't think of dogs as being moral beings. If a dog bites you, you know, you may initially get angry with him, but you're not angry with him in the way that you would be if a human being had bit you, okay? And you certainly wouldn't reproach him for doing it. It doesn't make any sense to address a dog and say, you know, you really shouldn't go around biting people. So human beings in Rousseau's view, in their initial condition, were a bit like sort of dogs and cats and other non-rational animals. They didn't really have any kind of moral position. And somehow something went wrong. And here's the interesting story. What's the villain in the piece? What's the snake in Rousseau's Garden of Eden? And the answer is agriculture. You go, what? Agriculture? Yeah, it was the agricultural revolution which disturbed this sort of Edenic condition and led then to all of the inequalities and nastiness which we now see in the world around us. And just in case you think this is some sort of mad idea, which, you know, sort of originated and then died with Rousseau, of course, it's become a commonplace. And indeed, we've seen it recently. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with a book by Yuval Harari, the Israeli author, called Sapiens. He makes very much the same point. They think that the agricultural revolution was a really, really bad idea, and that things were pretty good up to then, and that's when mankind really went downhill.
Well, let's talk a bit about property, because I'm virtually certain Rousseau is the guy who said something like the first person to, you know, I'm going to butcher it, but it's something along the lines of the first person to stand on a plot of land and say, this is mine, is responsible, you know, for all the butcheries and all the, you know, crimes of man against man that have ensued ever since. That is Rousseau, isn't it?
It is Rousseau. That's the guy, and that's very much the claim. That's basically, he thinks, you know, with the advent of agriculture and the longer time span, you know, that we need for the use of natural resources, then possession becomes longer and longer. And this, in fact, gives rise to property, and that then gives rise to conflict and the war of all against all. Now we're in a Hobbesian position from which men desiring to escape, then they agree. And this is Rousseau's really key point, that in agreeing to this notion of property, in the interest of security, the mass of humankind is in fact fooled into accepting an inferior position.
What can we say about this conclusion about property? I mean, what does he envision, first of all, as what would replace the institution of property?
Well, interestingly enough, he doesn't think it's possible to go back. In other words, one thing he's not saying is let's go back to that awful time and, if you like, put the time machine into reverse and go back. He realizes that there is no possibility of going back. Quite what he has in mind is not absolutely clear, because one of the points I make in my chapter on this in my book is that Rousseau, I think, is inconsistent, or at least at the very least, if he's not inconsistent, is unclear. It's very difficult to figure out exactly quite what he has in mind here, except that he's not happy. Okay, and like many people who are not happy, it's not easy to figure out quite what the source of the unhappiness is. Again, part of it, this is where we come back to the personal, because Rousseau personally was, first of all, we think of him as being French, but of course Rousseau was in fact Swiss and a citizen of Geneva, which was a very small and compact town. And then he found himself, if you like, at large in French society. And he would not have been a member of the aristocracy in any sense. He would have been under the lower bourgeoisie. And so he found himself, if you like, not really accepted, except as a kind of performing bear. In other words, because of his writings, he was tolerated, and he found that very difficult to accept. He also, interestingly enough, for him, his model of what society would be like if it was properly ordered was really based on his hometown of Geneva, and at a slightly larger remove, with the ancient Greek cities. This was his ideal of how society should be organized. One thing in his favor from the point of view of a libertarian was he rejected completely the notion of representative democracy, simply because there was no way in a very large state, for example, this could actually give effect to what people really wanted in any way. It would simply be a way of sort of installing effectively tyranny masked by sort of pseudo-democratic forms.
Yeah, that is an interesting thing about Rousseau, that he's one of a very, very small number of modern thinkers who are expressly not speaking about a system that he thinks is applicable across a large expanse.
Yes, that indeed. And it's easy to dislike Rousseau and to reject what he says, and I do dislike him and I do reject more of what he says, but there are parts of his thinking where he actually manages, accidentally or otherwise, to hit on something I think that's correct or true. So the idea of the sort of large-scale modern state, which had been only in existence, if you like, in his time, for roughly only about a century or maybe 150 years, was not something that he found appealing, and not a situation in which human beings could have any of the various kinds of freedoms that he thought they should have.
All right, I want to turn now, if I may, to The Social Contract, which is such an important work of his. Even if it wasn't read so much in his own day, it's had a tremendous influence down the couple of hundred years since it was written. So let's do that after we thank our sponsor. Folks, as you've heard me emphasize on this show again and again, so many people leave their formal schooling with absolutely no skill that can earn them above minimum wage. Well, as usual, it's the private sector to the rescue. Skillshare makes available to you over 20,000 classes that can teach you a new marketable skill, help you improve your existing skills, and in general, make you a more attractive candidate for that job or a more skilled entrepreneur. For just 99 cents, Tom Woods Show listeners can get access to all 20,000 classes on Skillshare for 2 months. These are classes in areas ranging from animation to film production, fine art, graphic design, illustration, music production, photography, writing, accounting, business analytics, entrepreneurship, finance, leadership, management, marketing, productivity, web development, culinary studies, and more. Get 2 months' access to Skillshare for just 99 cents when you go to Skillshare.com/woods. That's Skillshare.com/woods. All right. When you talk about The Social Contract, there are a number of ideas in there that need to be explained, the general will perhaps chief among them. But before getting to those, try and explain what is the difference between the social contract, so-called, as Rousseau understands it, and other forms of social contract thinking that we see in thinkers who preceded him?
Oh, yeah, that's a really very good question. I wish I had a sort of snappy answer to that one. I don't. One thing I think at least is clear, that sometimes when people talk about social contract theory, there are two broad ways of understanding this. One is that somehow people got together at a particular time in the past, sat down and had an agreement, which then is the source of the order, political order, from then on. Rousseau doesn't think that, right? He doesn't think whatever the social contract is for Rousseau, it's not an historical event, right? Really, the social contract for him, and I think I'm correct in saying this, but again, I have to make the point that it's really difficult to be certain about anything in Rousseau. I think I'm correct in saying that for him, the social contract is to be understood, as it were, sort of counterfactually. When we look at society in the way in which it is organized right now, we, as it were, by participating and being a member of society, we have, as it were, virtually contracted, even though we actually have never sat down and have never been asked and have never signed a piece of paper. So it's something like that. If we were to think of it in modern terms, it would be something like you would get in the writings of, say, of John Rawls, where, you know, so behind a veil of ignorance, people would choose, if you like, an order in which no one would be massively advantaged and no one would be massively disadvantaged. Of course, we never find ourselves behind a veil of ignorance. This is a sort of hypothetical construction. So to that extent, Rousseau's social contract, the idea of contract here, is really, I think, a hypothetical entity rather than an actual entity.
All right, well, let's think about what John Locke would have had to say about the relationship between the individual and the state. I mean, he would have thought of it as a situation in which people come to some rational understanding that they're all better off if they delegate some of the powers that they enjoy, he would say precariously in the state of nature, to a central authority so that they may enjoy the remainder of their rights more securely. But I don't believe that's the way Rousseau thinks about what's happening at all, because at least in Locke's formulation, even if he doesn't seem to think, he doesn't talk about secession, he doesn't talk about, he does talk about revolution a bit, but at the very least, you still get the idea in Locke that the powers begin with the individual delegates a number of them, a small number of them, but is still kind of the one in charge and reserves to himself a lot of powers. The sense that you get from Rousseau is the individual is involved in a relationship with the government in which he's all in. Like he's relinquished all of this stuff, and now it's up to the state to distribute back what it chooses.
Yes, I think that's largely correct. I would say that for the mature Rousseau, no, I mean, people have argued that, you know, when you go through the various writings, his position is moving, and that may well be the case. But for the mature Rousseau, it's clear enough, I think, that the collectivity comes first, and that the individual is a distant second. And once again, I think you can understand what's going on here if you see that Rousseau's model is immediately the city-state of Geneva, but more importantly for him, the city-states of ancient Greece, where this was exactly the case, where people were citizens first, and individuals, if they were anything at all, a long way second. So anything for him, anything that an individual has of value, his desire for happiness or language, all of these come from society. They're all, as it were, given to him from the collectivity. So clearly this is nothing like what you get, say, from Locke, where the individual has rights, has property, and then, if you like, makes various concessions in order to provide, as it were, security for his tenure of that property. That's not at all what you're getting in Rousseau.
Now let's introduce the concept of the general will to help bring everything into, I was going to say clear focus, but ha-ha. But I am interested in this idea of the general will because, of course, this has been used, and indeed it almost it's begging to be used, in a totalitarian manner.
Yeah, this is, what can I say? It's an extraordinary notion in some ways. Who was it? George Sorel. Said that Rousseau was unintelligible, but his unintelligibility didn't matter. and that the idea of the general will wasn't to be taken seriously. In other words, it wasn't so much that it wasn't to be taken seriously, that it was beside the point to try and understand it. I think that what's going on here, again, if we try to grasp what's going on, it's something like this. The general will, first of all, what it isn't. It isn't something that you arrive at by counting heads. So let's suppose we have 1,000 people in our state. So we issue a questionnaire and 999 people want something. So that is the general will. Okay. Now, that's not at all what Rousseau has in mind. The general will isn't actually the will of an individual citizen, and it isn't even the will of the majority. It's sort of counterfactual. It's the general will is what everybody would, in fact, will if they were to abstract from their individual biases and concerns, right? So it's not actually anything factual in that sense. So somebody has to know what that is, and it may or may not actually coincide with the desires of an individual or a group of individuals or even the majority, but there's no necessity. It's perfectly possible, by the way, in Rousseau's thinking, for the general will to be something very different from what the majority actually wants.
Then the question obviously becomes, who then is able to divine what the general will is? And that's such a fundamental question that I fear that Rousseau scholars out there would be tut-tutting me for having such an elementary question. But pardon my impertinence here, it's begging to be asked.
Well, exactly. So how do we know what this is? Do you look into your heart? Do you consult the oracles? What do you do? How is one to know what the general will is? I mean, those of us who've been around, whatever misgivings we might have about representative democracies, we understand how it's supposed to work. In other words, it's supposed to be some kind of majoritarian way of organizing things. But this is not the way the general will works at all. So, in fact, in order to try and answer your question, Rousseau actually introduces another perplexing notion, and this is the idea of the legislator. Now, not a legislature, but the legislator, who is one person whose task is to bring about the conformity of the diverse wills and to produce, if you like, and clarify what the general will is. Now, you might say, well, great, that's terrific. How does that get us out of a problem? And then the answer is it doesn't. Because if the idea of the general will is obscure, and it is, then the idea of the legislator is scarcely less obscure. You really are explaining the obscure, but even more obscure. And here's, by the way, what the legislator will do. Okay, and this is to connect up with your remark about totalitarianism. The legislator his job is to persuade people to obey the laws, but not by argument, for arguments would be too abstruse. The people, you see, aren't amenable to reason, so they must be persuaded by some other means, and that's the legislator's job. Now, if that sends a shiver down your spine as it does mine, there's a reason for it, because, of course, we saw how this worked in the first third of the 20th century. Okay, in this case, the legislator was their Führer, and so on. So, this notion sort of really worries me. I mean, as I said, it's hard to read such passages now without being reminded of National Socialism, Fascism, and indeed Bolshevism. And indeed, in the case of the USA, certain activities of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who, in addressing Congress, challenged them that if they weren't prepared to take on the job he thought they should do, he was quite prepared to do it by himself.
Now, again, I feel compelled to ask a fundamental question, and it's just the kind of question that would occur to anybody hearing this for the first time. It seems to be the case that you're right, that the general will is, I don't know how we figure out what it is in a particular case, but the idea of it is we strip away all the private wills, all the private interests that might be tainting your ability to view things from a bird's eye, dispassionate, disinterested perspective. And once we clear away these private interests, we're getting closer and closer to what the general will would be. But this idea that the legislator would have special insights obviously suggests that the legislator is some kind of special individual with whom we do not have to worry about peeling away private interests. But this is silly and superstitious to believe this. Even if there were such people, how do we know we could identify them? Who would be doing the identifying? Well, a bunch of people who apparently are loaded down with private interests. How would they choose this particular person? I mean, does it seem like – it seems to me you're just overwhelmed with logical objections here.
Well, not only logical objections, but practical ones. And again, if I were to stand up and say to the Irish people, I will be your legislator, okay? I will discern for you the general will and tell you what it is. And the rude answer would be, well, who are you? Okay. And where do you get these magic powers from? And how are you in touch, as it were, with the divine here? And how can you reveal? And the answer is, I would have no answer to that. And so it's an immensely practical problem. And of course, it doesn't explain the general will at all. It just introduces another level of complexity and another level of obscurity.
I want to follow this up with what problem Rousseau thinks he's solving by writing The Social Contract. But I don't want to interrupt, even though I just did. But just put that in the back of your mind. That's what's coming.
Okay. I want to make there's something which I think is really relevant in today's society, and particularly in the context of current events that are exciting us socially and politically. And that's the whole idea of false consciousness. And of course, I mean, this notion of false consciousness has had a long innings, and it comes up in various ways. But the basic idea is in Rousseau. Remember, the people weren't capable of being persuaded. They weren't capable of responding to reason. And in that case, you're treating individuals as if they were children. Now, it's perfectly appropriate to treat children as if they're children, but not adults. And so the idea behind false consciousness is that somehow I or my group, we are the enlightened ones. Okay, and we know what's really good for you. You, on the other hand, don't. And therefore, even though you express your desires for A, B, or C, we have to tell you, unfortunately, that A, B, and C won't really make you happy, aren't for your good, and therefore you are prey to false consciousness, but we somehow magically and mysteriously are not. Now, this, I think, is simply another version of the legislator, except that there are more people involved here. And of course, you see this all the time. You find it, for example, in radical feminism. For example, they will say, you know, women might say, well, we don't think of men as the enemy, and we don't have a problem with many of these things, and we're reasonably happy. And then they will be told by the radical feminists, well, unfortunately, that's false consciousness. You simply have been indoctrinated in various ways, and you don't really know what's good for you, but we somehow do. And we will therefore tell you, and so on. And the fact that you expostulate and say, but no, really, really, this is what we want, we will pay absolutely no attention to you. And this, of course, is a deadly notion, because this creates the notion of some group of experts, whoever they might be. And it's not just in feminism, radical feminism. It can be in any area who, as it were, somehow, like the legislator, have the capacity to know what's really, really good for people, as a thing from the plebs like us, who don't.
All right, so let's get back to that other question I was asking. What's the point of the book? What problem is he solving in his mind?
Well, the problem, I think, okay, the basic problem here is the basic problem of any political order, which is this. Some people tell you what you must do and have the power to enforce it, and other people are being told what to do and can be forced to do it whether they want to or not, right? That looks like we have a two-tier structure. We have the commanders and the obeyers, right? And as long as you have that structure, the question always arises, why should those, I mean, apart from the threat of force, why should those people who are, if you like, told that they must obey, what reason do they have, apart from the threat of force, if they don't, for obeying the commands of their alleged superiors? And there, so you have, that's your basic problem. If, however, and this is the key, if, however, you can persuade the mass of the obeyers that what they're being told to do is really an expression of their own will, properly understood, then the gap disappears.
That's exactly it. That is exactly it. That way it doesn't, because I think the whole, now his relationship with the Enlightenment is interesting, but I think the whole Enlightenment is very uncomfortable with the idea of some people exercising authority over others. And so I think that's partly where the whole social contract stuff comes from, is so that we can get at least implicit consent out of this, tacit consent, so that we can say, look, it really is you who are governing you. It's not really some external force governing you, because we all know that's barbaric and from the olden benighted days. But no, it's you governing you. And so this is Rousseau's own way of explaining how it could be that you're governing you, even though it's obviously somebody else telling you to do something you have no desire to do.
Exactly. It looks like tyranny. It looks like force and so on. But, you know, as he notoriously said, you must be forced to be free. You might say, as you protest, I don't really want to do this, or I prefer to do something else. And again, in this kind of paternalistic fashion, you're being told, no, but this is really what you, if you only knew, I feel like, what the general will is, if you only weren't prey to false consciousness, you would realize that what we are now, unfortunately, forcing you to do is, in fact, for your own best interest, and something that you would really want to do if you only could, as it were, tap in to this sort of general will. And it's an ingenious idea, right? Because if you buy into that way of thinking, then you've wiped out the basic problem of politics, which is, why should some people rule and why should some people obey? Okay, but unfortunately, I think for most of us suspect that we're being sold a pig in a poke here, that this is not perhaps as obviously correct as it might be. And of course, if you're on the commanding side, if what those who claim to know the general will or to be in possession of a true consciousness, if what they are proposing is in line with what you want, then of course you don't feel it as an imposition. If people are forcing you to do things that you would want to do anyway, then they don't really have to force you, do they? I mean, you would do them in any case. It's only when there's a discrepancy, a disparity between what it is that you want to do and what other people are now forcing you to do, that you will feel that there's something wrong about this. But then you will be told, no, it looks like, you know, this is kind of some kind of coercion and so on. But really, we are just giving expression to the general will, to what is in fact your own will, even though you don't know it.
Finally, can you just say a word about what Rousseau's views on religion are, but primarily how they fit into the political order?
Oh, well, now, again, this is this is one area where I think he really goes back to Plato. Plato, in his dialogue, The Laws, had an almost identical view of religion, which was to see it as a tool, as an instrument, as it were, of social control. Forget, if you like, that it might have any possible relationship to a transcendent reality here. But here, the civic religion would, if you like, provide some kind of quasi-religious grounding for the social order. And people would be, in fact, forced again to subscribe to this. Because of that, of course, he was radically opposed to Christianity, because, of course, Christianity, even when the church is conforming with the state in many ways, there's always a possibility, always a danger, that at some stage they might actually remember what they were supposed to be doing and provide, if you like, a counterpoint. Okay, as in Romans chapter 12, where it says, be not conformed to the world. There's always a danger that the Christian religion might not be conformed to the world. And in fact, he writes to Voltaire in 1756, he says, there can exist religions that attack the foundations of society, okay, which is clearly Christianity. And then he goes on to say, and one has to begin, wait for it, by exterminating these religions in order to ensure the peace of the state. And of course, what do we witness in the subsequent centuries except attempts to exterminate religion because of the possible dangers that they pose to the state?
Well, that is a good place to stop and sum up here. What would be, if you had a minute to explain it, what would be your summary of your case for what makes, as you say in your book, the thought of Rousseau both authoritarian and totalitarian?
Well, he, like many authors, especially because he's unclear in many ways, he has been, if you like, taken to be the source of various political ideas. But I believe that he really was, even if he didn't intend to be, and maybe he did, maybe he didn't, he was actually a proto-totalitarian. And to that extent, I think he really has to be seen as the sort of political godfather of the politics of the 21st century, of the 20th century. And let's hope that he will not be the godfather of the politics of the 21st century.
Well, with that, we will wrap this up today, but I want to remember to urge people to pick up your book. Now, tell people the full title again.
It's called Freedom's Progress with a Question Mark.
And the subtitle is?
Is The History of Political Philosophy.
Okay, so this is the book that we've done a number of episodes talking about different sections of it. The material on Rousseau is quite copious and very, very good, but the whole thing is just an amazing treatment. And you have to remember, it'll be a little more expensive than your average book, but that's because it's about 8 times larger than your average book. So, and you're going to be getting about 12 times the knowledge from a typical book. So think of that. Factor that into your purchase decision. We will link to the book, of course, at tomwoods.com/1148. Professor Casey, thanks again for your time. Always a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Tom.
All right. Well, that's enough totalitarianism for one day. So I've got something uplifting to tell you about. How about this? A couple of doctors have started a new podcast called The Paradox. Of course, it's spelled P-A-R-A-D-O-C-S. See, it's a play on words. It's a discussion with a couple of doctors on the practice of medicine. It's a show for physicians to learn more about what's going on and a great way for their friends and family to better understand the challenges they face. But whether you're a physician or just a patient and a consumer of healthcare services, you are going to find this a very interesting and useful podcast. As one of the hosts puts it, as a libertarian physician anesthesiologist, I am unafraid to discuss what's going on in medicine and critically examine the role government, insurers, patients, physicians, pharmaceuticals, and other players play who are preventing us from receiving the best health care possible. So they've already got a few episodes up. One is an episode with Congressman Amash about the state of the Affordable Care Act. Then he says, I examine the corrupt influence of specialty boards with the process of maintenance of certification and how it is driving physicians all over the country into early retirement. This is stuff we laymen don't know anything about, and yet physicians struggle with. And then he says in another episode, I explored direct primary care and got the story of how switching from a traditional insurance model of primary care to direct primary care transformed the life of a physician and helped her deliver better care. So a lot of great topics with a couple of very knowledgeable people. So check out their website, which is where you can find the podcast, theparadox.com. And of course, paradox, once again, P-A-R-A-D-O-C-S. I'll link to this at tomwoods.com/1148, as the listener website mentioned. And again, remember, make sure you get your hosting through me when you go to start your website, because then I will give you publicity and other bonuses that are really going to help you, especially as you're just starting out. So check out my bonuses at tomwoods.com/publicity and how you get them, and I'll see you tomorrow. But wait, before I let you go, I'll tell you that 2 episodes from now, if all goes well, will be our debate on Russiagate. So is it a big deal or is it nothing at all? We're going to be debating that in just a couple of episodes from now. So make sure and stay tuned for that. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.